You're listening to the Exploration Films Podcast. A deep dive into films from around the world. Conversations with producers, directors, and actors, where they discuss the behind-the-scenes stories of filmmaking and also reflect on their motivations and their worldview as storytellers. Hosted by Renaissance man, sage, and thinker, Carl Moeller.
I'm so excited today to be here with John Stonestreet of the Colson Center and Steve Greisen of Exploration Films. Man, welcome, guys. Welcome to have you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, thanks.
You know, we're talking today about film and culture, two of the best examples of people who are making a difference, or at least seeking to make a difference in our world today through Christian Worldview at the Colson Center and through relevant films that make a difference that inspire faith journeys. Welcome. Steve, I'm going to start with you first because I know you a little bit. I know your background. You're an MK from Hong Kong. How does that happen? And a music guy, a guy who's produced, you know, been a musician, produced musicians. Mm-hmm. How do you end up in the film space? Where does that come from?
Well, it's interesting. I think living internationally, growing up in third world culture gave me a different way of looking at the world. When I came back after high school and I realized that a lot of kids in America lived in neighborhoods, in row houses, and I thought my life wasn't like this. I grew up in a little village, fishing village, you know, and where I walked by fresh catches every morning, and my whole life was just different. I rode a train, I rode a double-decker bus, I rode a ferry, you know. But I got out of that when I left after high school. I had to figure out what was next, and the Jesus movement was underway, and that had a big impact on me as a young person, because here was an expression of faith that was in my language, music that was coming along that was brand new, that was our music, that was influenced by the people we love, like the Beatles and other people. And so that led me into being a young musician, and to fast forward, did that for a bunch of years, met my wife who was also doing that. But when that wrapped up, I always had an interest in film. And for me, it pulled together three things that were sort of already established in my life. One was my dad was a photographer. We had a darkroom in our house. And I grew up learning to shoot still pictures. And that was the composition, lighting, framing part. Mm-hmm. I was a natural writer. I could write stuff, and while I couldn't spell worth a hoot, it was pretty readable when it was done. And I was a music guy. So those three things come together as a core of learning film. And of course, when I started, I was terrible, but you know, that's for another story.
That's another conversation. Yes. But it's also really fascinating because of your experience being transcultural, right, from an Asian culture. Hong Kong, I mean, admittedly, I've talked to a lot of MKs, their third culture, they're not there and they're not here. Mm-hmm. There's something different altogether. It kind of gave you sort of an objective way to look at using music and eventually film.
It's true. You know, I did a lot of client work when we first started in film. And one of my things I just loved doing was in every culture you go to, so Western pop had dominated the world, right? The world was moving more Western. We weren't becoming more Eastern.
Right.
But what was interesting was you would have, like, you'd be in India and there would be indie pop, or you would be in Asia and there'd be Asian pop, right? Sure. And it would have the influences of the culture, which I loved all those cultures, and at the same time, pop music influences. So it was really fun, and I used to collect this stuff, you know, and just to listen to it because I'd never get it back home. It was so interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I think growing up in Asia, in Hong Kong, you know, I see myself, when I say where's home, in my mind, it's Hong Kong, which is...
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most people wouldn't think, you know, immediately, oh, that's a Hong Kong guy.
No, because I'm a big white Danish boy.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. John, I'm so fascinated about your journey as well. You're an academician. You're somebody who's studied theology and history and philosophy, and you know, you kind of pull them all together here. But, you know, I'm always fascinated. What are you seeing just generally in our culture? What are the big trends right now that really call for a Christian worldview response?
Well, I mean, almost all of them, because so much is going on. But, you know, I grew up in a home where you kind of looked at culture as a place to stay away from. You know, it was something that you kind of lobbed condemnations over the safe walls of your church in order to condemn mostly of what you saw. And so the idea that Christian worldview brought to me that actually, first of all, that Jesus Christ is Lord of all, not just of the church, but of every square inch, as Abraham Kuyper said. Right. And that we could actually see things through our faith. It wasn't our faith versus the world. It was seeing the world through our faith. And so you look now at kind of where culture is headed, and there's a number of things, I think, that are that have to be addressed from a Christian worldview. I mean, the topic of film and media and so on is one of them, but as part of a larger story that Neil Postman wrote about, you know, back in 1985, which is kind of the over-entertainment of the world. So when art gets trivialized by entertainment, then it becomes even more important for people like Steve to tell really good stories, because we live in a culture in which, as Postman said, we entertain ourselves to death. And art used to be about, you know, thinking deeper thoughts about the world, wrestling with the ultimate questions, framing out what's good and bad, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, and why. And now it's very often just titillation of your senses. And it's a very different reality. And so the ability to go deep is one of the things that a Christian worldview brings. The other thing is that C.S. Lewis once said that the most dangerous ideas in a society aren't the ones argued, but the ones that are assumed.
Oh, boy.
And, man, when you talk about film, when you talk about music, when you talk about media, nothing assumes ideas more, right? I mean, you don't even have to remember, you know, way back in the old days when you have to rent the tape, and it was like,
be kind,
warning.
Rewind.
Well, before that, it was like warning, you know, the FBI will put you, will put you in jail. There's never a warning that says, you know, what you're about to get is a 2-hour dose of existentialism.
Wow.
Or what you're about to get is a thoroughly poorly argued but compellingly portrayed vision of sexual orientation. And so these ideas, though, come at us through these stories, and that's one of the reasons that a Christian worldview is so important. Now, and just in terms of media, and the last thing I'll say is that on a larger framework, this media is coming at us at a particular time, and I think this is probably where a Christian worldview is most important, where we've undergone over the last several decades what some people have called an anthropological shift. You know, where Christians kind of look, and that's a big word, but Christians kind of look at our culture and our life.
I'm from New Jersey, please.
Yeah, let me boil this down for you guys. But, you know, Christians can look at what's happened over the last 40, 50 years, and we can go, man, look at how much things have changed morally in our world, right? Things that used to be wrong are now right. Things that used to be right are now wrong. And they have, but more fundamental than that, the moral change that we've seen is the fruit. The root is a fundamental shift in what we think it means to be human. And that's, I think, the key point where Christian worldview intersects with our culture is in that question, what's a human person? You think about, you know, the bioethical issues, you think about fashion, you think about sexual orientation, you think about what it means to reform those who are incarcerated. I mean, you could go down the line and say that they're all identity questions, and film is delivering this identity crisis in a brand new way.
Right. I was going to follow up with that because, and both of you guys kind of maybe think about this from the different perspectives you bring. What have been some of the films, if you will, that either have shaped or reflected the shifts in our culture? So really...
Elf. No, I'm just kidding.
I love Elf. One of my favorites.
Come on. It was great.
Thanksgiving. You hear Elf sit on a throne of lies.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
You smell like beef and cheese.
See, I love you guys. That's what I love. There's definitely the cookies are on the bottom shelf
here.
But seriously, we look at the cultural shifts, and many of them are so confusing. And then, you know, then we, you know, go to media, we go to film, we go to other forms of that art form. And I think it's really important to recognize that, just as you said, this has been lowered to a certain level where film or other pop media is not seen as high art or anything like that to elevate our thoughts, but to really entertain us and to divert us from some of these challenges. But what are some of the, historically speaking, what are some of the films that you can think of that really have been fundamental in shaping the culture in general? I don't mean Christian films. I mean films.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that the whole modern ecology movement was launched on an inconvenient truth.
Wow.
You know, I think so much of it ended up proving to be hogwash. But however, it was the platform to launch the whole discussion, right?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big deal.
That's a big deal. You see a polar bear, you know, on a shrinking ice floe. You think, my gosh, I want to save that polar bear. It just bypasses our rational thought, right?
And the truth is, most people don't really think very deeply about anything in life anymore.
Yeah.
It just isn't part of what we do. We're inundated with data and information. We don't have time even to ponder deeply. And so that's sort of been removed from our culture. So as filmmakers, we're very skilled at convincing you with sometimes very little real evidence and thinking to back up. But yeah. we can move you in a whole different group of ways.
Yeah.
We can move you with music. We can move you with script. We can move you with characters you like. We can move you with stories that touch your heart. And none of it may be true. None of it may actually work at all.
It's working at a different level.
It's working at a different level. Yeah. Really kind of a soul level. Yeah. Right?
Oh, there's a great example of that. If you watch the Oscars every year, what you'll find is they go back and they honor the best pictures, you know, throughout the history of the Oscars. And you go back to, you know, the Ten Commandments and everyone claps. And then, you know, it kind of goes down to all these
Sound
remarkable
of music.
Films. Yeah. And then you get to the Titanic. And everyone kind of feels awkward. Like, and you kind of hear this kind of polite golf clap. Like, I can't believe we made that the best film.
Yeah.
Because what was good about it? Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah.
Except it was big.
Yeah.
Right? And
it
was this masterpiece of special effects that people hadn't seen before. And that's what James Cameron's always been.
Or Avatar.
At.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's exactly what Steve said. It moved us for that. It moved the whole culture for that year. And now everyone's embarrassed. It's true. You watch. People are embarrassed.
If I hear that song one more time.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's like, what a ridiculous thing, you know? And I think that's one of the interesting things is when it comes to the relationship between film and culture, sometimes film drives culture. A film can actually move the needle. You can look, for example, at Brokeback Mountain and how controversial that it was.
Right.
And now it's definitely part of the conversation of normalizing the LGBT movement. Joe Biden was asked, you know, once said that Will and Grace did more to promote same-sex marriage than anything else. That's really interesting because Will and Grace never dealt with same-sex marriage. What it dealt with was the two gay men who weren't, you know, as flamboyant as has been portrayed earlier and so on. So sometimes I think films and media and story drive culture. Sometimes it really reflects culture. So we could talk about films. The other thing to talk about when you talk about kind of what are some of the big moments, I mean, I think it was films, it was television, it was all kinds of things. The shift between the 80s and the 90s is a fascinating one. So you think about the most popular television show of the 80s was The Cosby Show.
Yeah.
I mean, man, now that's a more of a loaded reference these days because
Of
the things with Bill Cosby. But here you have a family-centric show. You have a moral in each and every episode. The kids made moral progress. They grew up. They went to college. They became adults. That was the 80s.
Right.
Fast forward one decade, and it's Seinfeld. And Friends.
Right.
The difference between Seinfeld and Friends as a storyline and The Cosby Show is all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
But if you look at culture, it was the difference between the 80s and the 90s.
Sure. Well, you know, and I think we can easily point, and I think we do, point at films as reflecting, you know, cultural values that we don't share in a Christian worldview. But I think there's also, there have been films from time to time that have, you know, sort of really elevated the conversation about a Christian worldview. And you know, some of the ones that I think of are like Hotel Rwanda, Chariots of Fire. I remember being, you know, I was in college during that time and I literally brought people to see this movie so that we could have a conversation over ice cream and coffee later. Maybe beer. But the reality was, I think there are some films out there that do elevate Christian culture. Anything on the, you know, that would also come to mind about the way Christian films can help us in the engagement with culture?
Let me just stop you there with that term, Christian films. I'm not a fan of that term.
Right.
What I am a fan of is Christian people doing films that reflect their worldview.
Mm.
And for me, my worldview is this overarching view that there's a master plan behind this whole world, that from the very beginning till the very end, there's this big overarching story. And that is the lens that I look at everything through. And so it's told through thousands of little stories that reflect that. And I think that for me is elevating. And from our mission, it's always been to say, well, let's just focus on stuff that elevates people. There's enough dark films out there and let the other people do horror films, zombie films, whatever. We want to do stories that sort of move people to sort of reach further and to dig deeper and to connect more, whether it's with God or their family or their communities or whatever it is like that, and be better, you know? Enough in the culture is calling us to be worse. Let's focus on being a little better. And so, you know, my thing is I think we need to be more comfortable with the Jesus model, and Jesus was a storyteller. He called them parables, and it was very simple. He didn't explain them. He laid out a story. And in some cases, just dropped the mic and walked away and exactly. didn't explain it. He didn't say, now I want to invite you to invite me into your heart. You
right, know? Right. There wasn't that scene.
He doesn't say, you know, this person represents this person.
Yeah.
He just kind of says, you know, for him who has ears to hear, let him hear.
Right.
And so story is that way.
Yeah.
So story gets to some people in different ways. And so we need to be comfortable telling a story that starts with a worldview that, and that's the Christian part for us, right?
Right.
We don't want to be pegged Christian filmmakers or Christian musicians or any of those things. Well, I understand why people do it, because your warm market needs to kind of understand who you are.
Yeah.
So I get that, but hopefully we can get beyond that in the future. Be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, John, I think what Steve's reflecting here is, I think, a very important observation, which is every filmmaker comes at what they do from a worldview perspective. And so in other words, they're telling a story of the world, whether they like it or not. As Christians, we believe that the Christian story of the world is not just a story, that it's a better story, although we believe both. We actually think it's the true story. And so this is what St. Augustine called spoiling the Egyptians, is that sometimes you can find some really amazing truths from people who are just living in the same world that we are,
yeah.
and we can't deny it. Arthur Holmes said, all truth is God's truth, right? So,
I like that.
Exactly.
And so I think, as Steve said, if you are a Christian in the film business, then you should be pointing to these deeper truths, yeah. the bigger story of reality, things that are distinctly impossible if God doesn't exist. That's one of the powerful things. Human value, meaning and purpose, yeah. forgiveness, I think, is one of the remarkable things. You mentioned Hotel Rwanda earlier. So these are, you know, kind of remarkable things, that there's something more than survival, for example, the bigger and better sort of motif. That's why some things are classics, right? I mean, why do some things stand the test of time and so many other things not, including quote-unquote Christian songs, Christian movies, mm-hmm. Christian? Because if you're not digging deep into the human condition, it's not going to resonate past a particular breath. That's the problem with Titanic.
It's the Titanic issue,
exactly.
I was going to say.
It's the Titanic problem. Whereas you go to Chariots of Fire, or you go to
Saving Private
Gladiator,
Ryan.
Saving Private Ryan. Right. Now you're wrestling with things that are a lot deeper. The other thing I think that's really interesting, too, in how we do this journey, and Steve's a great example of this, is that Thomas Friedman wrote, you know, several years ago, The World's Flat, and that the big Hollywood blockbuster distribution model, just like it happened with music, is starting to break down. So the ability to reach an enormous amount of people with really good stories without having to have a million, you know, billions and billions of dollars,
yeah.
that's becoming really powerful. And the, you know, documentaries, you know, nature films, the things that kind of point to the reality behind the world, now we're able to get right into people's living rooms. I mean, so that's one of the interesting things about Christians in this business, is now there's a distribution model that allows them to do their job, I think, a lot better.
That's so true. I mean, our first documentary that I did was called The Search for the Real Mount Sinai. And it was a story of, they actually never knew where Mount Sinai was located. And Mount Sinai is important because it was sort of the birthplace of Judaism and Christianity. The Ten Commandments were given there. The Ark of the Covenant was given there. It was part of the Exodus. So, you know, was all this a fable, or was this, can the Bible be trusted on these things? So we end up doing this documentary, which actually points to real evidence of this whole period of time. And it comes out, and the Christian community wouldn't pay any attention to us. And I almost felt like, you know, we'd found a cure for cancer, but nobody would look and pay attention.
It
was kind of like the Christian community almost needed to be told what to think about what we did first. But the guys that caught on were Vanity Fair, Delta Airlines, Dateline NBC at the time with Stone Phillips. Remember those? And, you know, then we had a call from all the heads of Disney to do a presentation to them on the discovery, because they were working on Prince of Egypt and they wanted to know about what we had found there. So all of a sudden, you know, you got a couple of people that working out of their basement in Monument, Colorado. These are heady times, right? But John's exactly right. From a distribution standpoint, now we can compete for eyes. And that's resulted for us in millions of people viewing what we do.
So it's absolutely the wrong time, in my observation of that, for Christians to pull away from film, cultural engagement like that. It's absolutely the wrong time. There's never been a better time.
Hey, listen, one of the reasons it's never been a better time is not just the distribution. It's also because, if you haven't noticed, Hollywood's run out of stories. No, really, the creativity's gone.
Star Wars 18?
Exactly. Look, it's like, okay, you can imagine like 75% of pitches at Hollywood studios right now are, let's do a sequel, or let's take the lead character and put a minority figure in there instead. Yeah. I mean, and not that that's wrong, it's just that there's no creativity. Yeah. Where are you seeing? You're seeing the disruption from the outside, right? Netflix series. The most creative thing that we've seen, you know, in recent years, probably Stranger Things, right? Just bizarre, but so compelling in so many ways. And also a throwback to the 80s existentialist films like E.T. and Goonies.
Nostalgia has a very powerful pull on some of us, bro.
And it's nostalgic without, you know, kind of redoing Star Wars for the 27th time. So I think, though, that that goes to Steve's point and your point, Carl, which is, gosh, don't get out of the business now. Like, the world is lacking good stories.
Yeah.
So it's not just that we've got, I think, you know, new ways to get the content out there, as important that, as that is. We've also got innovation and creativity on our side, and that's powerful.
I think it's really important, too, and I would love to get you guys' opinion on this, is it seems to me that some of the problems with Christian films, quote unquote, is that there's too heavy a hand on the steering wheel. I want to... the impact to go this way. Whereas you brought up Jesus in the parable, Steve, maybe talk a little bit about how we have a light hand or how we have to pursue films that have a light hand on that steering wheel.
I think a lot of that was just the finance part of it, that you know, in the early days, you would have sort of Christians being urged to go buy out theaters, and we got to make this movie a success because it's about some biblical thing that we love. And it wasn't a real economy. It was a fake economy. The real economy would have been if people said, I really want to go to that movie, went and bought a ticket, and it was sold out that way. And the other thing was, you had a certain percentage of the Christian community that were confused about this too. What is a Christian movie, just like we talked about earlier? Can we put that label on it? Does it have sort of a presentation of the gospel?
Yeah.
That was like the thing that had to be there. I couldn't give it my blessing. I couldn't send my family to it. I couldn't show it in my church. So that thinking is beginning to adjust now. And people are beginning to say, you know, great story, and that contains a truth that reflects our worldview is, again, God's truth.
Yeah.
And if we can teach people about forgiveness, if we can teach people about healing from brokenness, if we can teach people about love, and, you know, again, our job's not to teach everything in one movie all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we need to be okay with that. So
I think we need to have a higher view of the audience's ability to pull truth out of the storyline, and not just everything is pre-chewed and digested so that it's spoon-fed.
Yeah, I think you got a lot of things at work. I mean, one is I think filmmakers trying to do too much with one story. I think that's a big thing. But part of that comes from the evangelical culture, which is an interesting history. But evangelicals have always been more comfortable than any other kind of religious group and Christian denomination in using cultural means to get their message out, right? You can go back to Jonathan Edwards and newspapers. You can go, you know, to Billy Graham and movies. And part of that then kind of created, I think, and there's a lot of good to that, but it created this ethos of somebody else is doing the evangelism for me, right? What if the point of a movie could just be to make someone go, about one thing, trusting that the church is going to come and fulfill the Great Commission.
Right, or the Holy Spirit is actually going to be able to engage, right?
Right, like the film doesn't have to do it all. The film wants to bring the question so that when, you know, they're at Thanksgiving dinner the next Thanksgiving, that you can have the conversation that you need to have. And so that's kind of part of the professionalization of ministry that we've done in evangelicalism, pushing it out to certain people. And so I think that's, you know, kind of one of the problems. It reflects, I think it reflects more largely some theological issues in the church. The other theological issue in the church I think it reflects, Carl, is that we're really uncomfortable with mess. So we want things to have a nice, neat bow. We want the marriage to be fixed at the end of fireproof. You know, we want the... and I do too. I mean, don't get me wrong, but we don't live in that world.
Yeah.
And you can contrast those sorts of movies with Flannery O'Connor. You know, my wife is in this Flannery O'Connor kick right now. She was just telling me about this story of this little boy who goes to get baptized and he drowns. And that's how the story ends. Oh. And you're like,
wait,
what? That's disruptive, right? And what's more, like that, sometimes that happens, right? The, you know, Flannery O'Connor was great at showing that we live in a fallen world. Things don't resolve. There's hope, but things don't resolve.
questions.
We did this. Here's a practical story of sort of impact from our perspective. We did this series. It was years ago. It was something that we were – I look back at it now and cringe. You know, all artists are like this. You look back and you think, well, yeah, I can't believe I did that. It was terrible, you know. But it was a series called Incredible Creatures That Defy Evolution. And it raised a lot of questions about evolutionary theory and how these animal designs are so sophisticated and so complex. And a lot of times they all have multiple systems that all have to work all at the same time or the animal doesn't survive. You know, how do you live with a partial lung or partial stomach and all those questions? And that little series led was hugely popular in certain quarters. But we got a call one day from the Kansas State School Board, and they were considering whether or not they would be the first state in U.S. history to open up an alternate version to be taught in school, not just the theory of evolution. If it's a theory, then it should. Are there other theories? Is the natural question. So they requested a series of these films be sent to every board member in the school board. Plus, they had a lot smarter guys than us, PhDs and educators and so on.
Guys like John.
That gave guys like my friend John, who gave, you know, testimony. And they ended up saying, we're going to allow alternate teachings on this subject to be taught in our public school. Well, that's led to 36 states now. Last count, it might be more, that allow some form of an alternate teaching. So it may not be, say, biblical creationism, maybe intelligent design, but it may be, in other words, saying these are the views. Because one of the things that's clear out there on that subject is science actually has nothing to say about origins. In other words, we're all looking at the same information. We're there from a naturalistic point of view. We're looking at it from an assumption of this big story that God created the world. But it's one step forward on origins. So the origin discussion is interesting to open up because there's millions of people that hold to the concept that God created this world and that a lot of these processes were set in motion that happened. But behind this is a plan and intelligence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was sort of a practical thing that we thought, geez, you know, who would have thought that would ever happen? You know, you'd have kind of influence like that. Or, you know, we get a call from the only station in Mongolia, which is a huge landmass. And we do a television deal with one of our films for Mongolian TV. I don't even know what that looks like. Or I mean,
you're big in Mongolia, bro.
Big in Mongolia. Internationally unknown in Mongolia. Or I get a call from a guy named Tudor Pepin, who was the chief propaganda officer for Ceausescu during Romania.
Romania.
And he comes to Christ and he starts a television network in Romania. And so we start giving our films to Tudor so we can air them on TV. And that grows and grows and grows. And he's got the only channel in the whole country for a period of time, sharing his faith and his worldview with the whole culture in Romania. So, you know, it's interesting what happens. Fantastic. And those are the sort of the things you know about. And then the other questions are about how people then, millions of people see things and they think and they consider and it affects them in their hearts and all that other stuff. You can't possibly know impact, but you know it's going on. So.
So it seems to me, too, that, you know, we have the issue with documentary versus narrative, you know, like story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I guess the question I'd ask is, which one do you see having, you know, more impact on people's behavior?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, I know that features are generally more popular because people like stories. Documentaries, I love because that's my thing, but I grew up in a different world than most people. And so I grew up with real life being far more fascinating than anything Hollywood could write.
You
know, I grew up on the doorstep when Mao was in power in China. Yeah, and he just, you know, anyway, that's a whole nother thing. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, you know, for me, I remember a few years ago, I saw a film, Czechoslovakian film, Czech film from there. And it's actually all subtitled. It was called Most, which in English doesn't translate, but it's called Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it's the bridge story of the father who's the bridge operator. Maybe you've heard this story in church or sometime, where the bridge is a drawbridge and a boat is going by, a train is coming by, and he has to lower the drawbridge for the train. But little does he know that his son has fallen down into the gears. Mm-hmm. And so he's faced with that ultimate spiritual question. Does this train hit a bridge that's still in the up position and I save my son, or do I sacrifice my son in order to save an entire train full of people? Honestly, it was one of the most powerful, no gospel presentation at the end. But if you can't have the conversation about the work of Christ and the sacrifice of Christ on behalf of humanity after that movie, you need to go back and read your Bible. You know?
Yeah, right.
John, if we were to say right now, how do you recommend, you know, using film to either encourage or, you know, how we build our approach to the world around us? How would you use film?
Yeah, I think one of the maybe mistakes we've made is kind of a one size fits all for all audiences. I mean, you can, you know, immediately make a distinction between consumers and producers, right? All of us are consumers of films. Most of us are, but very few of us are producers. And so, you know, what are we looking for as a consumer? What lenses do we need to have? You know, Nancy Piercy calls it a baloney detector. I think that's really good, you know, to realize that every film, every story is communicating ideas about the world that are true and false, even the ones that are seemingly harmless, mm-hmm. even the ones that are just kind of nonsensical. I mean, there was this whole kind of decade of in the 90s where it was just kind of, you know, almost the absurd, right? Well, that's itself. When you're talking about Seinfeld or you're talking about all the Chris Farley movies that are really funny. But in a sense, it's also communicating.
We'll have a whole podcast on Chris Farley movies.
Yeah, on the legacy of Chris Farley. But, you know, in a sense, that's still communicating a vision of reality, that things aren't sacred, that things, everything is to be made fun of. Mm-hmm. And even though the way they made fun of it was pretty funny, that's different than a vision of reality in which some things are worth fighting for, living for, and that sort of thing. So you can, I think, distinguish between consumers and producers. You can consume, you know, you got to distinguish between kids and grown-ups. Yeah. I mean, that's a really easy one.
Yeah.
You know, I have 4 kids. My oldest one got into Stranger Things. That is a series, for example, that has matured. Mm-hmm. And it created a whole new set of questions mm-hmm. for her and I. You know, had I known what season 3 was going to be in terms of some of the issues, we might have, you know, held off on season 1. But we didn't, and they escalated. And so let's have this conversation. And mm-hmm. she's a mature girl. You know, my youngest daughter's not ready for that at any level.
Right.
I often think of the, you know, the Beauty and the Beast fiasco, the real life Beauty and the Beast, right, where Disney, who's just stellar at marketing, got my girls excited about the real life version of that film for, you know, a year.
Yeah.
And then a month before release, suddenly dropped this, oh, there's a gay moment, you know, in the movie. Well, you know, what do we want to accomplish there? And so, you know, you got to know kind of where kids are. You got to know what the messages are. You got to have your baloney detector up. And mm-hmm. I think that's about as universal as you can get. There are, as Steve described, he's done incredible nature films, documentaries. Yeah, I mean, just amazing. And that accomplishes certain things. There's been a real fascination with history recently, to retell history mm-hmm. and to retell it compellingly, mm-hmm. not just in film, also podcast. You know, mm-hmm. you think of Malcolm Gladwell or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that points to some really interesting things in our culture. And so all of this is, if the culture is willing to have really good conversations, then Christians should absolutely be at the table to have those conversations.
You know, one of the most rewarding things for me along that line was we did this World War II story. And I was always fascinated with the history of World War II because I always thought, man, those guys paid a price that probably will never get paid that way again mm-hmm. because we have smart bombs and missiles and everything, right. you know. But men mm-hmm. just getting mowed down. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Anzio, what, 52,000 were killed in 3 days? Yeah. That equaled the entire Vietnam War death in 3 days in World War II. I mean, what these guys went through in some cases was just hell. And we ended up doing this World War II story called In the Hands of the Enemy, America Surrenders an Army, and it was set in Corregidor, Bataan, and all that stuff. But for me to meet these kind of, at the time, 80-year-old dudes and to be able to sit down and hear them roll out their stories, in some cases, these guys, one guy in particular had been married 45 years and had never told his family these things.
Yeah. Wow.
Because that culture was about you do your duty. Mm-hmm. You come home, you put it aside, and you get on with your life.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't heroes. The guys that are dead over there are the heroes. And so that was the way they looked at it. And so humble guys did their duty, but they were also many times broken. But it, for me, it was just a spectacular way to touch that piece of history, and I was so honored to be a part of that. And yet here's these common themes of, you know, giving your life for others mm-hmm. and fighting for honor for your family. And I remember one of the questions I asked these guys, because they ended up getting terribly imprisoned in these concentration camps, one of the guys was hauling out with his buddies over 100 bodies a day as Americans were dying in that camp. Mm. And I said, you know, what drove you in your soul at that moment? And one guy said, hate. I just hated. I just, one day, I wanted to kill those guys. And another guy would say, I prayed. Mm-hmm. And I asked God to help me. But, you know, it was an honest way of looking at the journey, how people cope and deal with stuff. So, you know, anyway, I love the whole World War II theme.
Me too. I can get totally into that. And far as, you know, like Unbroken, you know, Francis Schaeffer at Le Brie one time shared how, you know, if you see the difference between, say, one story and another that is purporting to tell the same thing, you ask, what are the differences and what differences do they make? So if you look at the story of Unbroken, for example, in the book, there are two full sermons of Billy Graham in there, and the entire narrative post-war, post-traumatic stress, we'd call it today, where his life was spiraling out of control, but a conversion experience. That was Laura her name escapes me.
Hildebrand.
Laura Hildebrand wrote it unvarnished. You know, just what it was. It
right,
wasn't
but the
preaching.
Movie just stayed on the broken, not and the unbroken. Stayed. The unbroken came later.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the difference, you know, again, this goes to the whole point of narrative and film, right? The difference was profound. In the one, it was the inability of, even with his powerful ability to survive all of that, you know, that went on, and I won't give anything away for anybody who hasn't seen it or read the book. I'd recommend the book more than anything. Mm-hmm. But the ability to do that in the film was centered on him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. His survival. Mm-hmm. And in the book itself, it was his brokenness at the end of that was only, you know, given, you know, in a deeper way.
Yeah, Chuck Colson used to say that one of the key differences is what's the problem and who's going to fix it?
Yeah.
You know, that's another set of questions. Yeah. When you look at that, you know, what's the real problem here? I'm thinking of the, you know, recent film about Freddie Mercury and Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, what fixes it as at the end is a romantic relationship, you know, for him. But yet we know that, you know, really at his feet can be laid
many
deaths because of the AIDS crisis. So it's, you know, when how you tell what the problem is a key reflection of what you think is true.
Well, I feel like we're just getting started, but I did want to just say, you know, you guys have brought incredible insight into something that, unfortunately, we don't take enough time to really reflect on, the interaction between culture and film, not just as a mirror, but as a shaper and as something that we can also be involved in. And whether it's through the doorway at our kids' level or, you know, our level at a deeper thought process level or, you know, frankly, even at an entertainment level, you know, you did bring up one of my favorite movies, Elf. we have in front of us such amazing things. And Steve, I really appreciate the way in which you've taken on the opportunity to bring broad awareness to some of these underexposed films that are there. I mean, it's just absolutely encouraging to see some of the really great work that's being done. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't get the, you know, the promotion in the trade magazines or whatever. But, you know, hopefully, through things like this and other things, we'll get more people to watch those things and more conversations of consequence as a result.
I love this. Yeah, well, you two are a couple of my very good friends, so this is fun.
It's been really, really fun. So thank you guys for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. It's Steve, the producer of the podcast. If you liked what our guest, John Stonestreet, had to say, be sure to check out the Breakpoint podcast on your favorite podcast app. In that feed, they produce Breakpoint, a daily four-minute feature, Breakpoint This Week, a weekly summary of the news from a Christian worldview, and the Breakpoint podcast. Twice per week interviews, inspiring messages, and more. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. We understand you could be listening to any other podcast out there, but you chose to invest your time with us. We thank you. Please let us know what you think about the show. We value your feedback. So, continue this conversation by subscribing to our podcast on whatever podcast app you're listening. Visit explorationfilms.com for more information. And if you sign up for our email list, we have a free gift for you when you join us in this adventure. Thanks for listening.
That's a wrap.